Of a good name for a queer erotica story.
Oh yeah.
What goes down doesn't necessarily stay down.
Oh, I kind of feel like there's a double or triple or quadruple entendre there.
That's why it's a good title. This is what you get for riding
your
bike to work.
Youthful types.
All right, kiddo, let's do this.
Welcome back to episode 51 of People's Guide to Publishing. Your source for how to understand the publishing industry.
I'm Ellie Blue. I'm the marketing and editorial director of Microcosm, and I have opinions on the internet.
Mm-hmm. I am Joe Beal, founder and CEO of Microcosm, author of A People's Guide to Publishing, and something else that I can't remember right now. I have opinions, but I try not to inflict them on other people on the internet unless I'm actually prompted, such as when you send your questions to this program. Today, we are going to talk about another one of the major misnomers in publishing, the fact that more than half of publishing is educational resources.
So is that a misnomer or is that true?
The misnomer is that the majority of the publishing industry is bookstore sales,
false.
Which is not true. The majority is educational, I mean, worldwide. When I was researching and writing A People's Guide to Publishing, this was something that I was really intent on getting hard numbers for, and it's really hard to get this kind of information because nobody wants to be the source, even on, like, publicly available information. And then the other really complicating factor is everything is in different currencies because, you know, for example, Hachette does more business in France than they do in the United States or in, like, the English language world in general. And, you know, similarly, Macmillan does more business in Germany. And so when you convert all these currencies, it's really hard to pin down, like, well, what is the number? What is the total? Because, obviously, currency fluctuations can actually literally cause a multi-billion dollar publishing company to lose money because they have to convert it into, you know, whatever currency they are in the country they're based in.
I mean, all that aside, though, I didn't know this until just now, and I'm fascinated by just how much of the worldwide book industry is educational and textbooks. That's tremendous. Like, even if it isn't more than half, even if it's much more or less than more,
That's
still pretty big. So what is the educational market?
So the educational market is everything from, like, libraries and schools where, you know, a book is just, like, shelved and maybe never touched versus, like, reference copies, you know, like, University of California publishes a lot of books that, like, are their only role is to be, like, shelved in a reference library for somebody that is like, how many horses rode through the state of California in 1877? You know, or other such errata.
I'm just having a moment of pleasure that I left academia.
And then that doesn't even, like, touch things like textbooks, you know? Like, even, like, you know, if you just look at, like, the budget for the state of Texas to buy grade school textbooks, you know, let alone, like, university textbooks worldwide, let alone, you know, all of this put together, you know, it's just billions upon billions upon billions every single year. And that was really fascinating to me. I've actually been reading a blue British book whose name escapes me that is, you know, it's like some, it was published 7 years ago, so most of the data in it is pretty out of date. But it's really fascinating to see somebody else that really strove and struggled to be definitive with that stuff. And the trend they were really honing in on at that time in 2013 was that there were, for the first time ever, companies in China and Brazil cracking the top 10 of the global markets for biggest publishing companies. And the only way they were doing that was just by just trouncing into the educational market.
So what advice does this give us for, like, independent publishers that maybe have focused on bookstore books, but maybe you want to get into the educational market a little bit more?
You shouldn't.
Why not?
I mean, and that's my opinion. That's not based on anything I've read or seen, you know. I mean, I guess it's based on, like, the data that has been available to me that has formed that opinion. I'm giving my opinion on the internet. But the real reason is because then you have to compete with these gigantic companies that have much, much bigger marketing budgets than you do, and their entire role for global domination is taking over these educational markets.
Oh, fascinating. So Microcosm does publish some textbooks.
If we relegated them solely to the intellectual ghetto that is textbooks, they would fail.
Right, they're never only textbooks. Like, you can also sell them in a bookstore or a gift store.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
And so our, you know, textbooks in our annual budget, maybe 5%.
So,
like, you know, we probably actually sell more ebooks than we sell textbooks.
So can we talk, like, just real quickly about one specific example? And this is a book that we're working on developing now. It's a book called Women on Wheels, and it's a really cool book. It's by April Streeter, and it's a really well-researched and, like, funny also and fascinating history of women in bicycling and the very, like, scandalous stories that you've never heard. Everyone's heard that one quote by Susan B. Anthony about women in bicycling.
Right.
Boring. But,
and, like, oh, the racism on those people. Whew, was a doozy.
Yeah, but, like, what you don't necessarily know is this, like, whole kind of circusy scene, I would say, of almost sort of, like, burlesque plus sports that rose out of the 1880s and then kind of evolved over decades. And, you know, a lot of these women were kind of lone wolves. They, like, did their own thing. Anyway, it's a cool book. I shouldn't describe the whole thing, even though I'm obsessed, and the images are cool. But anyway, we want this book to be something that is beautiful enough to sit in a gift shop for somebody to pick up and be like, oh my god, I will need this cover tattooed on me, because I am a woman who loves cycling. We want it to be in an independent bookstore for somebody who's like, this is a cool slice of history I've never seen before, and it's very readable. And we also want it to be able to be taught in college classes about the history of cycling and the history of feminism and the history of sports. So tell us about the developmental concerns this leads to.
I really want to focus on the biggest market, which in this case is probably gift. Because, so what you're doing is that when you lean in one particular direction, you're sort of straining the others. And so gift is probably the most reliable because the sales are non-returnable. They're substantial. They tend to buy more than one copy. They, you know, they tend to sell through and reorder pretty well. And, you know, as long as the book is developed well for gift, it'll do really well. And bookstores are kind of similar, though they work in smaller quantities, and, you know, they don't give it as long of a shelf life as the gift shops do, oddly enough, because in a bookstore you have to compete with, you know, the all the millions of books in print, you know. Whereas in a gift shop, you really don't. You have to compete with the very limited selection of books that are developed for gift, you know? Though you do have to compete with the candy and plastic toys and, like, weird bedding and all the stuff we talked about in a couple episodes ago. Whereas in the educational market, you know, you have to look at, like, okay, well, how many people would potentially teach a class that would use this as a textbook?
Not that many.
Five? Ten?
Yeah, like 10 or 12.
Like, maybe, you know,
we had a
class, we had a freshman seminar at University of California, UCal system, and so we sold 300 copies of that book every new quarter.
Which book?
Oh, it was Indestructible.
Oh, okay.
We have another book, Action, that is used at 20 to 30 different colleges in the U.S. and Canada, and... But those classes are smaller. They're filmmaking classes, so they tend to be 6 to 20 people each. So even with that many colleges, the net is only really about 600 to 1,000 books a year sold, because a lot of those books then exist in the used market, because the book is 8 years old, you know. This is the reason why you'll see educational books that have a new edition literally every other year. Because for Women on Wheels, you know, you're going to have maybe 5 to 10 colleges that would teach a book about historical women on bicycles.
In small classes. And a lot of them will, like, share or photocopy their books. Let's be real.
And that's the other trouble with this stuff, is, like, the IP theft is a little rampant, and they just don't understand how little an author and a publisher makes. So they think that they're promoting you, but, like, promoting you to whom? The students that have already stolen your book?
So that's why when we publish a book that we know is going to be a textbook and picked up for course adoptions, we always put that consideration second or even third. Mm-hmm. We develop it for the trade or we develop it for gift, and then we make sure that, like, you know, the description on the back of the book shows the author's credentials and shows the book's history and doesn't get too woo-woo about describing it and is more straightforward. And that way it can kind of, you know, we can kind of have it all.
Yeah. And, you know, you just need to leave enough breadcrumbs so the right professors who want to teach such a book can find their way to it. If you're making an educational book, you really need to go big tent. You need to build, like, a math book that can compete with, you know, these companies that have so many billions of dollars behind them. So essentially you can't, you know, I mean, maybe you can, but you have to be really smart and really clever.
Or you need, like, access to a very specific educational market, like our friends at Bike Texas, who create bicycle curriculums for school children and mm-hmm. have been very successful in this because there wasn't any competition.
Yeah, and similarly, like, other technical markets, you know, exist, like, you know, books for chiropractors, books for city planners, books for various kinds of engineers.
But, like, the other thing about the educational market is, like, if you have a very specialized area that you or your authors can write in, that isn't, there isn't competition for that. Like in Joe's book, A People's Guide to Publishing, he talked about a guy we met at a trade show once who had published a very specific book about espresso machine repair, and he was able to charge $70 to $100 per copy because nothing else existed. If you want to know how to repair your espresso machine, you need this book. And he's not going to sell that many copies, so it actually really makes sense to put the price point that high to make it worth his while. So, like, if you can crack a very specific technical or educational market, it can be worthwhile, but, you know, like, you really need to, like, know the people and have your way in.
Or, you know, I guess the best example is the People's Guide to Publishing book, which was
a technical and educational book.
We did not know, but was adopted pretty well and widely for use as a textbook.
But if we were counting only on that, the book wouldn't have done that well. So thank you for buying that book.
Yeah.
Regular people and students.
Mm-hmm. This has been episode 51 of People's Guide to Publishing, the podcast. I am your host, Joe Beal, the autistic publisher, author of A People's Guide to Publishing, founder and CEO of Biker Cousin.
I'm Ellie Blue. I have been professionally having opinions on the internet since 2005.
No one wants to pay me for my opinions on the internet.
Thanks for watching and listening.
Thanks for joining us once again.
Please send your questions to podcast@microcosmpublishing.com so we can answer them on future episodes.
And please give us 5 stars on iTunes and everywhere else that podcasts are reviewed.
You can find us on the internet at microcosm.pub.
On Twitter at microcosm.
On Facebook at Microcosm Publishing.
On Instagram at microcosm_pub.
And here in Portland, Oregon on North Williams Avenue.
Thank you so much.
Have a wonderful week.